Welcome back to the Amazing Gamers Podcast, a just for fun production about media that matters and why we love it so much. Your host, Nathan Lamb, is not an amazing gamer, but he sure knows a few people who are. This is our conversation for today. And welcome back to the Amazing Gamers Podcast. We've kind of gone full circle in this first season of the podcast, and I'm kind of back at the beginning, at the end, if that makes any sense. Because joining me here today are two of the people who are right there at the beginning of when this whole thing took off. Joining me for the conversation today, first up, is it What Could Be Gaming? Adam from What Could Be Gaming?
What Could Being Be from Phenomena Gaming. Yep, that's me.
And you are the guy who brought me into the world of podcasting to discuss Persona 4 and the importance of having good media in your life. I'm really curious if that remake is also going to have that similar focus on the role of the media and as the collective subconscious. It was less so in Golden, so it's not an open and shut. But please, Adam, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to take the stage.
Oh, no worries. So yeah, so I'm Adam. I work with full-time job, not in content creation. So admittedly, the Phenomena Gaming really hasn't done much in a few months. So it's nice to come on a podcast and actually be able to discuss games. I don't have a long-term content creation plan. I keep thinking I'm going to make one. Don't have it. But it's nice to come and be on these podcasts. So thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you back. I'll tell you my secret. I visualize a conversation I want to have, and then I think about who I want to have it with.
Yeah.
And I take it from there. That's what it's all about. And then joining us for our second guest today, she is one of my favorite media critics working today, the Queen of Trails, Avenger Mags. Welcome back.
Aw, thanks for the super sweet introduction, and it's good to be back. My name's Maggie, also known as Avenger Mags, and a staff writer for the wonderful Nintendo Force magazine that I'm blessed to write in every couple months. So, thanks.
Yes, it's an amazing magazine. We love it. And yes, Jason is getting to the age where he's going to start reading your reviews. We watched that Donkey Kong Bonanza thing this morning. They were pretty hype. The pressure is going to mount good from here on out on the Switch 2.
I don't know how long people are going to be able to avoid it. I think when a lot of the like initial Switch 2 stuff came out, people were like, maybe I'll just stick with the original. But I think that Nintendo's got a lot of aces up their sleeve for this console. And so it's going to be exciting to see what else they have in store because everything looks good so far. I am biased, though. So, yeah. You know, write for Nintendo Magazine. You can take that with a grain of salt if you want. Like, totally fine. Doesn't offend me. But those are my thoughts.
I think you're biased in favor of good games, Maggie. That's been my experience in dealing with you and knowing you.
Well, I'll bring some difficult questions on that.
The challenge. That's fine.
I have thoughts on some of their policies with the Switch 2.
What's your top one with the Switch 2?
The fact that they can brick your console from a distance for any reason they deem whatsoever, and that you don't physically own the console because you're basically just buying a license to it.
I don't love that. I don't love everything as a service. You know what one kills me, and it's not exactly the same? I was watching a movie on HBO recently. There are commercials on HBO now. It's like, it's nothing sacred. My time had value once upon a time. I could own media and just watch it without being pitched. And so it's in that same sort of thing because it's the streaming. I was like, this is enough to make me hate streaming. Like, you know, it really was. Because anyways, but yes, that is one that I'm not a fan of. And yeah, your thoughts on that one, Maggie? Have you run into that yet?
Honestly, I've not thought about that a lot. I feel like that was kind of like maybe a retaliation from them for folks who like hack their console and try to like do different kinds of things with it. And I'll be honest, like, I don't really know a lot of that realm because I just kind of like use mine to play their games and I don't really try to do anything beyond that. So I'm not going to like pretend and say like I know everything about it or why that would be super bad, because I just don't really delve into that stuff. For me personally, though, it's like I don't feel like I'm ever going to do anything to where they would have to like come for my console. So I'm not worried about it, but I can understand people being concerned about things that they've done and what they've decided. I know like the game key cards are a big point of contention as well. And I think it's totally fine to call them out and disagree, you know, what they're doing and offer criticism. But for me personally, like I love the console for what it is. And I think a lot of people do. And so I think as long as like, we're not like just kind of like poo-pooing on people who enjoy it, it's fine to criticize and call them out. But I'm sorry, I don't know a ton about that specific issue. It's just not really something that I've ever thought about happening to my console or really thought about it deeply.
I would say it's a high level ethics question that ties into things that I work on a regular basis because I work around ethics. So I didn't expect you to necessarily have like an answer for that. Just more of like high level looking at work for navigating around organizations and that are doing like coercive control practices. That's where a lot of the thinking on like, well, why do we have so many situations where an organization can just control something that you technically have bought and purchased as something that you own?
Well, they don't really want you to buy and purchase it anymore. They want to rent it to you as a service. I don't love. I would like to claim that I have this high ethical standard that would make it so I'd never hack my Switch 2. The reality is I'm completely inept technically, so there's no chance of me doing that. So I'm in the very low risk category when it comes to that one. There was a couple of questions I did want to put to both of you because we're talking about new games. Yep. I have a momentous occasion that only comes up a few times a year that's happening right now for me. I'm finishing up a AAA game. It's the rare, you know, it's like a lunar eclipse almost these days with the busyness I've got going on. Yep. And it's really got me thinking two topics that I wanted to ask both of you. And the first one is, I'm curious to hear about the next game you're eyeing in the immediate future and why. And I can give you a moment to think about it because I'll give you my two because I'm in the market. I'm cruising the market. This is not something I do a whole lot, you know, like every 6 months maybe. So Steam sales coming up. I'm definitely thinking of getting Trails to Azure when it goes to sale. I loved Trails from Zero. I can't wait to see what happens next. I'm probably going to buy that and play it on Steam when the Steam sale hits next week. The other one is like a sort of out of left field. Romance of the Three Kingdoms, which is a turn-based strategy game about ancient China. There's a remake of Romance of the Three Kingdoms 8 that came out that's like massively expanded. And it's the same price as Azure. I'm going to have to see what the sales are. For me, going to Romance of the Three Kingdoms land is kind of an immersive experience where you have this like wonderful, soothing music, these beautiful portraits. You've got these epic heroes. It's kind of been described as the Iliad of China. And it's got like a ton of scenarios and different people you can play as, and they all have different abilities and things. So I'm on the fence for those two, and I'm excited for anyone who is having these sorts of decisions because it is fun to get out there and see what's out there. Do the two of you have your eyes on anything at the moment?
Yeah, actually I do. I mean, I'm currently playing Rune Factory Guardians of Ozima right now and absolutely loving it. I don't really even think I've scratched the surface of it fully, so I'm gonna be playing that one for a while. But there are a few games like that I'm looking to like kind of dig into on the horizon, maybe either at the same time as Rune Factory or perhaps like later this summer when I kind of finish everything I want to in that game. One of them is called Until Then. It's an adventure game from 2024, but it's getting a Switch port at the end of June. And so I heard really good things about it. It's got this beautiful like pixel art style. It's set in a fictional city that's kind of, I think, based in like the Philippines, though. Kind of follows this guy after a global catastrophe happens, and there's like branching dialogue and choices, kind of a nonlinear type story. So I kind of like playing things from smaller studios kind of mixed into kind of just like the normal like JRPGs that I play. It's nice to throw a couple of like indies. So I'm looking forward to that one. And then there was also a game that I played at PAX that's supposed to be coming out this summer called Demon School. And it's kind of like a Persona-esque experience with a female protagonist, which that is a dream. That combination is just a dream for me personally. But basically, you are kind of like a teenage girl who's from a line of demon hunters. And you make friends, and you can kind of like bond with them. You can fight demons, and it's kind of more of an RTS kind of style combat. Like you make your moves and you can kind of see how they're going to play out and then you execute them. And then everything kind of happens all at once after you've made your decisions. But yeah, it was really fun to play at PAX. It's from a smaller team, but I just love to support projects like that as well. So those are kind of two that I'm looking forward to playing, hopefully in the near future.
I'm kind of sold on Demon School just from what you told me about it. Is Rune Factory another RPG?
It is. It's an RPG slash kind of like farming sim hybrid. And it also has like relationship and bond building. Like you can build relationships with certain characters. You can get married. You can kind of do a lot of the traditional farming sim things, but it also has more of an exploration action RPG vibe as well. So it's all these different things that kind of come together.
Adam, do you have any that you got your eye on at the moment?
Well, I've got a few I've got my eye on at the moment. So today I'm going to go pick up my copy of Rideout Remastered.
Nice.
I am very excited about that because I was like, oh, an Atlas game. Oh, an Atlas game that would normally cost me $250 to find, plus I'd have to buy a system I don't own. Yeah,
very, very, very
Atlas. You know, yes. they short printed all their game because they didn't think they were going to get a ton of sales. So yeah, if you have original copies of some of those old ones, they're like $200 now, and I'm like, because I see them in my retro game store. I'm like, wow, if I had room for a PS2 and money to build a collection, that would be a place, but. So I am going to go look at Rideout. I'm going to play a lot of Rideout Remastered. I just finished Final Fantasy V last night, which was kind of a first. I hadn't played that one yet. So I really enjoyed Final Fantasy V. I do think it's funny that the boss's name is X-Death, and that was as creative of a name as they could come up with in Final Fantasy V as X-Death. But
I think he was kind of supposed to be a buffoon to some extent. I don't think you're supposed to take him too seriously.
Yeah, there's not much you take too seriously in that game because Gilgamesh is just a huge joke too, and a lot of good one-liners. And
but that was his first appearance.
Yep.
That was the first appearance of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Did you steal his armor?
I stole a bunch of stuff from him. So
you got to steal Gilgamesh's armor and the music. Battle on the Big Bridge. We will also get to Nobuo Uematsu today. Yep. So that was very timely. I'm glad you finally played that one and you liked it. You enjoyed it.
Yep.
I did too.
Yep.
I did too.
Yep.
The job system. It basically introduced the job system as we know it.
Yep. And did it in a way that I had to look up, like, okay, how does all of this piece together? And it's like, oh, that's, and then you go to one place, it's like, oh yeah, your freelancer job is what you're really supposed to bring everyone back to after you master a bunch of jobs. I'm like, oh, that would make more sense. Yep. Yep. Took me a guides and the game, and I still don't think I 100% get how all the leveling and pieces work for that, because you get certain abilities, so someone smarter than I am would have to explain that to me at some point.
Did you take the Omega weapon?
No, that thing murdered me.
You need to have like all of the freelancer stuff if you want it. That thing is a beast. That was like the first optional super boss in Final Fantasy. And it is a monster. Yeah. Yep. No, I beat it. I think I died like 25 times and then I finally beat it. It's a monster. It's so fast and it just can wipe you out and you don't have a chance. Oh my gosh. Sorry.
Yep. Yep. Omega and Seryu. That game had two optional bosses. It had Omega and Seryu, and Seryu is worse.
Worse than Omega Weapon?
Yeah. Wow. I tried one fight in the first attack did 7,000 damage to all my characters, and like, nope, I'm not built for this. So, so I will also be playing Death Stranding 2 when that comes out next week. Death Stranding 2 on the beach. If you guys remember our friend Hailey Ginger or Miss Alley Cat, we had a two-part discussion on Death Stranding a couple years ago with the first one, and so that will definitely be a game where I'm sure she and I will end up having a discussion at some point about Death Stranding 2, because I think we're both really excited for that one. And then Lost Records Bloom and Rage, I have to play part 2. I played part 1, really liked part 1. It's a visual novel style game. It was free on PlayStation Plus, which was really nice. Nice. And just, it's a story where you are in just like suburbia 1970s America, and you have to just navigate life as a teenager, but also there's weird stuff going on. And I have to remember what the weird stuff is when I go back into the game, because I haven't played it in a few months, because part 1 and part 2 released separately, which for me and how I take in games like that, I tend to like to try to do everything at once. But had another friend from Germany that really liked this game. I'm like, oh, I'll play it. We could chat about it. But yeah, I gotta play through part 2 of Lost Records, Bloom and Rage.
That sounds kind of like if David Lynch directed a Persona video game. I'm thinking of like Blue Velvet or something like that. Like, I think that was one of Kyle MacLachlan's first, but it was like that. It shows you like this perfect suburban home with this lovely lawn in the opening shot, and then the camera pans down and you see like the worms underneath the lawn, the perfectly manicured lawn. It was very David Lynch, but
I think media have, at least for like indie gaming, has like an interesting sense, because there's been there was another game that came out called Bloomtown that I played earlier this year. And that is also a game set in like suburbia, where it's like everything seems idyllic, but then it's like, oh, you have like weird aliens invading, and you have like corruption going on in the city, and you have like just weird stuff going on, and you're playing the game as like a 10-year-old child encountering all of this. So it's where that game gets some hot like connection to like Earthbound, or kind of like, oh, this is a bunch of kids looking at a weird social circumstance. So I don't know if everybody had like Earthbound nostalgia this year, or if there was something going on within culture, but yeah, there's been those two games caught my attention of like a theme of like, we're really digging into what American suburbia was like. And
not your dad's Scooby-Doo.
Not your dad's Scooby-Doo.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah.
Now, my second question, as I pack up Rebirth, because I'm reflecting on what really worked for me on this. And I would say Rebirth, I'm just going to say it really quickly. I think early on, I really enjoyed it because it was very focused on the characters and the relationships. And it goes from this kind of cardboard cutout outer personas that we never get past in Remake, which fell flat for me. It felt like a game that went nowhere. Contrast that with Trails from Zero, where you have a group of four people and they're initially like that. And by the end of the story, they've all seen each other and know each other. And you love all four of them, and especially the four of them together, because of the way they complete each other. Like, that's the contrast that I will put out there, and I will just walk away. The thing I liked about Rebirth is that you start to see, it sort of has that arc like Trails from Zero, where they start calling each other out, like Cloud's tough guy Merc thing and Barrett's bluster and all of the different things that they initially put up. And Red 13, by the way, who starts talking with Ryuji's voice once he returns to his hometown. That was the same voice actor as Ryuji from, he sounds like this very wise, sage old man when they first meet him. When he goes to his hometown, he starts talking like Ryuji because he's actually a kid. Spoilers, by the way. Yeah. But when it took the focus onto exposition for the story, it kind of started taking on water for me. And this is a common thing with Final Fantasy, where they'll make great characters that I love. You're in it for the people next to you. As the seminal scene from the Final Fantasy series says, You are not alone.
Yeah.
You are with a great group of people. I bought that magic card, the You Are Not Alone one, best scene in the entire series from Final Fantasy IX. When they go away from that and it starts focusing on the story, my eyes start glazing over a little bit. All of these mini games that you're doing all over the map, it's pleasant enough, but it starts to kind of pile up instead of building towards something for me. The thing I will say that I like, though, these moments that absolutely landed for me are these moments where the soundtrack is playing and it's like an orchestra doing classics by Nobuo Uematsu. And those are the moments that just so land for me. And I realized it this morning. I used to think Nobuo Uematsu was like the George Harrison of classic Final Fantasy. You know, like with the Beatles, you had John and Paul. And then George was this amazingly talented person who, you know, found a way to fit in and get. I think if you're really going to go to the heart of what made Final Fantasy so special to so many people, it's basically that you had 10 games in a row where Nobuo Uematsu was going to compose things. And there were going to be things on that soundtrack that you would remember that would become part of the rotation for a concert series like Distant Worlds, which still plays classics by Nobuo Uematsu. And for me, I made an intention this morning to just bring up how much I appreciate what he brought to us. I think he's more of a John or a Paul. If you're going to talk about what made the series what it is, I think the music has always been a huge part of it. And he is really a huge part of it. They still work with great people. My main memories of recent Final Fantasy games are usually centered on the music. And then the characters would be second. And then whatever else would be next. But that's my favorite of today. I want to ask the two of you, for your favorite OSTs, series with music or a game, the one that just really sends you. And I'll throw one more out to give you a moment. When I was in college, playing with my Super Nintendo, and my favorite video game was Final Fantasy VI, then called Final Fantasy III. I would be on the world map with Terra, like outside the Opera House, and I would stop the game and stand by the Opera House so I could listen to Terra's theme, the overworld music. It was one of those games. Video game music used to kind of suck, and you would turn down the sound and listen to your own music. The Final Fantasy VI was when that trend started to reverse. And my son does this. I see this with my son. He'll be playing a game, watching Kindle, listening to music. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, okay, turn all of this off and immerse yourself in that experience of the music of the game. Because that's how it really should be. Unless you're playing, I don't know, Call of Duty. I don't know what Call of Duty is like for music anymore. But I believe that immersing yourself in the music should be good enough to play with the game on. Have the music up. And that's, so it's an important factor for me. And other gamers might emphasize other places, yeah. But for me, the music is always an important factor. Is there anything that really speaks for you that is like important for you when you're thinking of a game or a series, that music is like one of the first things you go to? Because for Final Fantasy, that's me with Final Fantasy, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first thing that comes to my mind is the Xenoblade series. Specifically, that whole series is very strong when it comes to music, very strong. But Xenoblade Chronicles 3 was where it really blew me away. One, just in general, that game is in my top 5 games of all time. Like, it's just an incredible RPG. But the way that they integrated the music and the motifs in that game is like just so good and creative. To just give a little context, in the game, you have a party of 6 and 2 of the party members play flutes, and they have a very specific role in game where they're known as offseers, and they send off people who have passed in battle. It's like their souls are sent on when they play the flute. And there are so many instances in the soundtrack that feature the flute. And so it has this like amazing connection where it's a beautiful like music, it's a beautiful soundtrack, but it also connects to the story and a specific character role as well. And the way that it all ties together is just so beautiful. And there's also just like this amazing moment when Xenoblade 3 was nominated for a Game Award, they played a part of that song at the Game Awards. And there's this this flautist, and he's iconic, and he got to play those parts. And so it's just such a beautiful thing, the way they tied it all together. And I think that's the best example for me of how, like, a video game soundtrack kind of transcended just being background music. Like, it was woven into the story and the purpose of these characters as well. And I don't think I've seen anything better than that.
I'm going to go a couple different directions here. One is just, I'm going to start with Uematsu, because between all of the games that he has done music for, and I could not come up with a full list of them because there's so many. But I remember Lost Odyssey. I remember Blue Dragon. I remember, and those were Xbox RPGs that I was playing when I had an Xbox 360 in college and grad school. And I'm like, for a system not well known for RPGs, Uematsu really worked with them and had two really good scores in both those games. So just, and there's one person I knew in college that did his piano, like, concentration with Uematsu's music. Like, he would, like, recreate that with, like, piano scores, and it was just really impressive. So Uematsu in general, yeah, like, sad that he's retiring, but he's worked a good life and deserves to retire. Overall, just, he's just great. But to tie into, and the way I'm taking this question is, what soundtracks would I put into, like, a Spotify playlist for some reason? Not like, I'm taking it as, like, a separate thing of, like, like, yeah, a soundtrack that sticks out to evoke a particular set of memories. So a couple of them. Grease. Yeah. Grease. G-R-I-S. Or Gris. Or who knows if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
When I need a calm set of music to concentrate on something at work, that is the soundtrack that goes on. And that game, how it evokes color while using music to emphasize change in tones or change in scenery for a game that's basically a walking sim. There's no combat. There's no real story even. It's just, you're starting in a world with no color, and you walk through the puzzle and the mazes, and you work to restore color. The soundtrack is just top notch in that game. Like, one of the best soundtracks I have ever encountered. That same publisher created Neva. I have not played Neva yet. But there's other, like, indie soundtracks also. Like, Journey has a really good soundtrack. Why am I not thinking of a couple others right now?
Is Grease on all consoles, or is it on...
It's all consoles, yeah. Okay. You can get that pretty much anywhere. Neva, you can get pretty much anywhere, too. That's games for me. I'm waiting for a sale on that one, but yes, Neva I'm looking for. And then Celeste. And Celeste is a soundtrack where I don't get in the particular mood for that soundtrack often, but when it's, I need to laugh at myself doing something stupid repeatedly, like watching how many times I died in certain parts of Celeste, like, that's the game and soundtrack that reminds me of that. My partner could attest to, why am I laughing so much during playing this game? And it was like, I am just dying in weird ways and trying to get through a very good story with a very difficult platformer. And that was... Platforming is off-genre for me. I normally don't play platformers, but I'd heard so many positive things about the story and the game, and just the tight gameplay in Celeste, where I'm like, I have to play this. And I really enjoyed it when I played it a few years ago. But yes, that soundtrack I still have around in terms of, like, playing through that. But, and then more on genre, The Legend of Dragoon,
which I've heard so much about. And so the music might be part of why people talk about that one so much.
Oh, for a good number of those songs, I can remember the location. I can remember the plot point. I could remember where on the overworld I'm at with the various music. Like, they did a good job of tying distinct music to specific locations and scenes in that game.
Yeah, I'm going to play that at some point. When it eventually gets remade, I'll play that. And I mean, I could download it on my PS3, but I just hate dragging that thing out. It's such a honk. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the right word for it. It's kludgy. It just does not make me happy to see that thing. It's hard to go from the PS5 controllers back to those PS3 controllers, man.
Yeah.
I always see the post, like, why doesn't anyone talk about Legend of Dragoon being remade? And I'm like, I think there's like at least 1,000 people on social media, but that's like the only thing they talk about. They should all form a group or something. But that game has a hardcore base of fans who really love it. And for that reason, it's kind of been on my radar, and it's clearly made an impression on you as well. I had one thing I wanted to bring up before we get to Xenoblade 3. Xenoblade X, which I did watch the trailer for. I want to talk about critics, because I think all of us have reviewed movies or media at some point. So Maggie, as I introduced, Maggie, one of my favorite critics working today. You're much more than a critic, but you write game reviews. And I've always been a fan of game reviews. And I think it's because I was an old English major. And part of being an old English major is you kind of unpack what makes an experience great or not. And I think the most practical application you could have for that sort of endeavor is whether you would recommend it to somebody or not. And I've always felt that that is really the critic's role. And I'm not sure when I go in the discourse how much people understand that always. I think there's a few different things going on there that I'm hoping we can unpack. I think the one I would start with is when a critic likes or doesn't like a game and people kind of take it personally. And sometimes I will go and read the review and I'll be like, how reasonable does this sound? I mean, there was a think piece in the outline where it was some guy saying, I don't want to do my chores in Red Dead Redemption 2. Like, okay, how is this a thing? But okay, all right, somebody wrote an article about it. I read it. He's writing about how he was like playing Fortnite. He's like, I drop in, I'm blasting, I'm building. I was like, okay, why don't you go play Fortnite then? No, but he was writing a piece about that. So it's like, sometimes I try to judge, like, how much is it in their wheelhouse? Who is this game for? Does it accomplish what it sets out to do? Does it win me over? Or are there things that make it so I can't possibly enjoy it? And full disclosure, I had the pinnacle of my writing career in some ways. One of them was I wrote a review for Nintendo Force Magazine earlier this year. I have it framed on my wall. Civ 7.
Yay. I see it.
Proud, an amazing moment. I did go and talk to Maggie and ask for her pointers. And I sort of put my thesis out to her. I was like, this is how I sort of view it. I'm putting myself in the shoes of somebody who has some interest in this game, potentially. How can I be helpful in indicating whether they might like it or not? And what was my experience like? And to sort of really unpack it, like to take note of things I might not always notice, like were there things I loved about it? Were there things that were annoying? So for me, that's what I see it. I'm really curious to hear from Maggie, because Maggie has written hundreds.
I would say dozens. I don't know about hundreds yet, but hopefully I'll get there.
Oh, you're going to be there. But your own thoughts on that endeavor. I'm sort of curious how you approach it.
Yeah, of course. Well, I have to say, I think I received the best advice about writing reviews from a fellow critic and reporter that I used to work with at the Knoxville News Sentinel, which is the newspaper in Knoxville, Tennessee that I worked at right after college. And he told me that, ask yourself, what would you say to a friend about the media that you experienced? What would be like the first couple of things that you'd want to just like blurt out to them? And that can kind of help you figure out what the review is going to look like. And I still do that to this day when I have played. I mainly review games at this point, but after I play a game or even when I'm playing it in the moment, I think about like, what are the things that I'd want to tell my friends about first? What would I want to make sure that they know about this? And I start there. Of course, you have to refine it and add context to that. But I start there and I think about that because I think your review, like, yes, it does need to be your opinion. It doesn't need to be only your opinion. Yes. You need to provide context and details about the game or whatever you're reviewing so that someone who hasn't played it understands what you're talking about. And I think sometimes I read reviews and it's just all opinion. It's all someone talking about that. And I don't think that's super helpful. I think that you have to be able to make sure that the reader knows where you're coming from and why. And you back up like your opinions with certain things about the game, elements, whether it's gameplay, story, characters, whatever the game is like really focused on. And you add that context in. So that's kind of how I approach it. And I also just try to think of a clever way to like lead into it because that's always fun. And I think that's the hardest part is to kind of like think about how you're going to reel someone in to read like what you think, because how are you going to make them care? Like you want something that really draws in. So that's kind of how I approach it is I just think about like, what do I really want to mention about this game? How do I build around it to make sure that people who haven't played understand why it matters? And then also just coming up with creative ways to like lead people in and kind of keep the flow of the written word going well, especially if it's like a written review. Like those, I want those transitions to be snappy. That's like one of my favorite things to try to figure out. So that's kind of my perspective on it. And I think ultimately the heart of every review is to help someone figure out if this piece of media is worth their time and money. Like that should be the goal. Like it shouldn't just be like a venting session for you. It shouldn't just be like spewing out like different gameplay elements or things like that. It should really kind of be having a heart of helping someone kind of figure out if this is for them or if it's not and helping them make that decision.
You are pointing directly at one of my strongest convictions. It's like, I have like 25 takes that I could bust out on any given day. One of them is Siskel and Ebert had it right. It's thumbs up or thumbs down. This whole concept of a score, which you are making it a number, it is still subjective. The fact that it is a number does not make it objective fact. I am sorry. It is still subjective, the number you are giving to that game. But people argue about the number as if it's some sort of objective fact. And it's like, no, man, it's thumbs up or thumbs down. Do you recommend it or not? And I find that that whole Metacritic score thing is just my it numbs my skull. I don't understand the point. It's like, would you recommend it or not? Or would you sort of recommend it? Adam, if you do you read reviews? Do you write them?
So my media content work has actually, I have not done like a direct game review in the same sense of I write about all of the different aspects of a game and then tie it to like a verdict on whether someone should buy it or not. What my writing has tended to focus on is what are the different narrative elements that a particular game is trying to talk about. Think about how does this foster character development. My main research interest and just interest really in general is human behavior. Why do people behave the way they do? And when I'm looking at the question of the media critic, I'm always looking at the question of what is the critic's role in supporting pro-social behavior? And in gaming, there's a lot of great narrative and narrative arcs and character work about what it means to have pro-social behavior. Yeah. And it's also difficult to talk about. Like, it's not really a sound bite piece. And I think this is where I've found difficulty in how do I build out the kind of content I want to write. Because there aren't a whole lot of people doing it. And some of the ones that have been recommended to me, I'm like, I don't want to make a 2-hour lore video on very specific details, because my goal in my writing is always, how do I inspire someone to think about and act differently within their community? Now, that ties into the kind of work I do as like full-time work too. So part of that is also I'm trying to tie in some of the gaming I do with kind of how I think and process situations at work in a way where it doesn't always work. Like, there's definitely pieces I've written in my own content where I'm like, this was good for me to think about as an individual, but it doesn't necessarily work as something broader context with engaging with others. So in terms of the role of the critic, I see my role as someone thinking about how behavior is inspired because of the video games we play. But that makes me a pretty non-traditional critic in that regard. And it's hard to write ethics-based reflection in a time where people are just needing an escape from needing to think about ethics on a basis because of the flood of information coming in. And so that's also where I'm like, I need to take a step back and like, what am I really wanting and inviting people to do? Like, I know the type of work infrastructure I'd want to build with any content creation work that I would do. I know the business model. I know how I would legally incorporate the business model so it doesn't get bought out by a big tech company. I know how to build a cooperative organizational structure. I know all of those pieces. The big issue it for me is always, how do I connect with what is popular? How do I do something that's authentically myself? Because I'm pretty weird. And I admit that just at the outset.
I'm pretty weird too. So
yeah.
Same.
There we go.
And then the third piece for me is, how do I connect with the history of what video games is and has been and will be?
Can I give you one piece of advice on the writing piece? Because and I don't do this to set myself up as some expert, and just someone who's been writing forever and loves it and loves talking about it. John Steinbeck had the best piece of writing advice. Forget about the idea of a general audience. The general audience does not exist. You want to think about the person that you're writing for and then work it out from there. And honestly, I've read this too, and it's related. I read the forewords to books. I'm like in the very small percentage of people who do this. And one of the best ones I've read recently was by the noir writer, I think John McDonald, who wrote an intro for one of Stephen King's books because they were friends. And he's basically like, at the beginning, he's like, Stephen King did not write these stories for you. He wrote them for himself and he enjoyed them. So he shared them with you. And I think those two things, think of somebody specific to write it for. It could happen to be you. And I think those two things, if you create something that matters to you, the odds are it's probably going to matter to someone else. And I just want to add one more thing. One of the reasons why Roger Ebert was the GOAT is because he wrote reviews. He also wrote think pieces about movies. They're called the Great Movie Series. They are amazing. If you ever want to see a real life example of one of my biggest influences as a writer, it is Roger Ebert's Great Movie Series, because he adds that ballast, that context, that larger view. He kind of flexes a little bit. I don't know how helpful that is for you, Adam, in terms of that, but it's that same sort of thing where he's doing a different level of like cultural and historical analysis, and he's synthesizing it to sort of put it in a context of like a wider context, which I think is what you're talking about. Do you like reviews, though? When you read reviews, do you generally enjoy them? Do you take them personally? Like, if somebody slags like a game that you didn't like, do you go in and read it and be like, well, all right, I see where they're coming from, or don't? Or is it a case where it's like a bad review? Because I think Maggie was talking about that. Maggie touched on that earlier, where there's reviews you don't agree with, and then there's bad reviews. And life is complicated because both of those things are out there. Yep. And you kind of have to figure out which is which.
And for me, it kind of in terms of like how I even think about the playing of a game. Because for a lot of people, I usually have like a 3-point, like the 3-point scale you talked about. I recommend I recommend within certain circumstances if you have certain interests, or I don't recommend it. There's very few games that I don't recommend in terms of like the game is broken and I'm not wasting my time with shovelware. I don't have time to sift through shovelware to find the gems in the shovelware.
Shovelware? What's shovelware? Is that like Shovel Knight?
No, like, okay. No, meaning games that somebody will just throw on there. It's like when we talk about the Switch store having a bunch of porn-based games, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Shovelware. I see you're having fun with that shovelware. You played 900 hours of it on Steam. Excellent. Yeah. All right.
Right.
Yeah. So
I do have mutuals. Mutuals are coming to mind anyways.
Yeah. So when I'm reading reviews, there's certain authors that I will read for, like, I know I've known them for a while. I know how their writing style is. We might come to different conclusions. But definitely can be like, if I respect the ability of this person to write about this particular topic. And I also will read reviews for games I have no necessary intent of playing if I have a friend that's written it, because I'm like, okay, I at least will get a good sense of who they are as a person and why this game stands out to them. Even if I'm like, yeah, I can't do Elden Ring, or I can't do Dark Souls 3, or like, you loved it, or like horror games. A few people that have reviewed horror games where I'm like, you wrote a really good review here. I could not do this. Like, I could not play this game. But when it comes to like specific games I'm interested in, I actually don't read a lot of reviews ahead of time.
I might
look at the Metacritic score to get a consensus just to see, oh, is the game broken? That's about the only thing I will really use a Metacritic score for. Yep. Or if I'm playing Fantasy Critic with some people, of like, oh, I want my Metacritic score to be high on this game to see how I can. Yeah. But in terms of, I basically just don't want to see a Metacritic score in like the 55, 60 range for a game I'm looking to buy, because that means usually if it's that low, it's usually something's broken or it's unplayable for some reason. But other than that, I actually don't read a lot of reviews because I want to experience it myself without having it be filtered. I like engaging with the primary source myself first. And then using that, and then maybe talking with some people that I know have played the game kind of afterwards.
Two thoughts on that. One, if you're a parent and you're buying for kids,
need reviews.
Very helpful. I agree with you. For myself, I want to experience it blind. As a parent, if you're thinking about buying it, I find them immensely helpful. I definitely read the Mario Wonder review in Nintendo Force, and I agreed with it after playing it because it raised questions about the difficulty, how easy it was to leave the other players behind, which was different from other games in the series. And I was like, yeah, they nailed that one. They got that one right. Probably my favorite review ever, and this illustrates the other way I use reviews. If I really like a game, I'll read a review after the fact to sort of see, not if I'm going to write about it, but if I want to see what someone had to say about a game. Probably the best video game review I've ever read, and I'm sorry if I brought it up with you before, but Jason Schreier's Final Fantasy 15 review for Kotaku was amazing. It was, I mean, just as somebody who is a writer, it's told in the context of someone who's been a fan of the series since the Nintendo Entertainment System. He gives like about 100 words on what each experience was like from different points in his life, returning to the series over and over again. He puts going into the world of Final Fantasy 15 into that context. And then he tells you about, like, yes, this game is not perfect. When it's good, it's good. It's got some moments that are going to make you groan. And he ends by sort of, it's sort of the journey continues, that he had a lot of fun with it. And it was just an amazing piece of writing. I've cited it and linked to it numerous times. For me, that's like an example of what's possible when you bring, I have to imagine he's a fan of the series to have been able to write something like that. Because he nailed the stuff like, oh yeah, I heard that if you kills 600 brontosauruses in the forest in Final Fantasy VI, that General Leo will join your party. Just the goofy rumors that were out there when we were kids and stuff that absolutely doesn't happen. Like, there's just some shared experiences in there that I loved, and it was inspiring for me. So I love the medium, and it's interesting. There's always like two or three times a year people have this like trend of, and I noticed it's been IGN lately. IGN will write something that everyone gets mad about. And, you know, I don't know if it's trolling or not. For me, it's like, okay, is it something I'm interested in? Do I really want to know? Probably not. But sometimes I'll see people raging against the critics, like saying X, Y, or Z about their favorite series. I always wonder what's going on there. And I love it that we were able to discuss that today, because I think they do an important service. And I think that's really, do you recommend it or not? And I think if you leave it at that and they're taking that responsibility seriously, I see no issues there. I have been remiss. Xenoblade X, the floor is yours, Xenoblade fans.
I have about like 100 hours plus later after finishing Xenoblade X. I have a lot of thoughts. And I wrote my final review for Nintendo Force for the upcoming issue. I hadn't played enough of it to really have a final review in the previous issue. So that was kind of like a review in progress. So this next issue will have final thoughts. But I guess just to give a little background, Xenoblade X was the second Xenoblade game that was made. It's very much different than the numbered entries. There's Xenoblade Chronicles and then 2 and 3, and then there's X. And X kind of feels more like a spinoff because it's a little bit more sci-fi. Xenoblade as a series has some sci-fi elements. It also has some fantasy in it, but I feel like X definitely leans more sci-fi. And to just provide just a little bit more basic, because I know you've not really played this series, Xenoblade's kind of known for a couple of key things. One, big open worlds with a lot of stuff to do, a lot of monsters to fight, lots of locales to see, beautiful open worlds. Also, amazing music. The combat is also very interesting. It has some kind of MMO elements with auto attacking. But then you also have the action RPG element of using specific abilities at certain times to make combos. And those combos can lead to different types of attacks and increased damage. That's just at the very like simplest sense of it. And then lastly, it also is kind of about how Xeno as a prefix means alien, you know, that kind of like unknown element. But Xenoblade as a series also grounds itself very much in the human spirit and tackles a lot of issues of how, what would you do as a person when all of this craziness is around you, and how the human condition and how we respond to certain things and certain stressors as we go through different things. And so that I feel like is when Xenoblade is at its best, is when it really focuses on that. So with Xenoblade X in particular, the basic premise is Earth is destroyed. You are on a ship and you crash land on another planet that you've decided to start turning into humanity's new home. And so much of the game is you as a custom created character, kind of joining an organization called Blade to help develop the planet Mira into a hospitable world. And it is very much not hospitable when you get to it. And so it's kind of like the struggles that come with that, the challenges, but also just the absolute beauty of exploring a completely new place. And so that's kind of the background on Xenoblade X. I don't know if you have specific questions about the experience, but that's just kind of like the basic context of like what this game is and what the series is.
It was quite different from what I saw in the trailer than the one I played, where you're basically riding around up in the clouds on the back of dinosaurs. And but the combat part, I just could not get into the combat, and I had to put it down and walk away. I might circle back to it at some point, because there were things I really liked about it. I could not really figure out how to make the combat work, but Adam probably did because he's stuck with the series. So I'm curious for your thoughts on it.
Well, and it, the combat, the auto attacking pieces, that does take some time to balance out. Like, okay, how do you do the auto attacks? What sets of skills? Like, am I gonna have a juggle build? Am I gonna have a ground pound build? Am I gonna have like a skill bit, like a like magic based build? Because you have some spellcasters in there. I find the spellcasters harder to use, so I usually use either a juggle or a ground pound build, so you can like juggle your enemies in the air and they spin around. It's kind of a fun animation. What I would also say in terms of just the overall gameplay is it does have that MMO feel, because you can step into an area with a level 80 monster very easily. And it's like, oh, well, I wish I had not stepped right in front of a level 80 monster that noticed me, because their attack did 20 some thousand damage to my level 20 character. I'm like, uh-oh. So, which can be fun. Like, that's a good laugh. There are also points where I'm like, oh, especially with like the earlier ones where it's like, I need to get to a quest objective and there's like one path I can get around this level 80 character. And if I miss it by a couple of steps or time their walk wrong, it's like, oh, nope, I'm not going to get to this quest objective. So, what I've stuck with in terms of the series, I played through one. I think I maybe got stuck on the final boss, though. Like, I don't remember beating in that one. I remember getting real close, though. Two, I gave up on partway. I have to go back on that one. It got a little too anime feel for me at points. And I think the serious tone of one and then the less serious tone of two kind of threw me off a little bit. I definitely, and the blade combat was a little bit harder in that one, like with the like different sort of gacha mechanic, but only like in game, and you have to draw certain blades out. Like that took, I got a little confused there. Three was really good. Three was where I was like, okay, yep, I get what this series is trying to do. And it's made me think like, okay, I got to go back to two and Torna and really tie up that end a little bit more. X, I really like. I just got hit with other releases that I wanted to play, and kind of got jumbled in my order of games, and thought I'd finish Xenoblade X sooner than I did, or sooner than I was able to. I did not. I've got about 75 hours in. I've still got probably three or four chapters to go in the main story, and then a bunch of side stuff. The side stuff's really fun to do in X. I really like how they highlight the characters, how some of the big hunts are tied to particular NPCs that you build relationships with. I like that you have a stable relationship scale. Like, I think X does that very, very well, where it makes sense. Like, oh, if I do X behavior with a character, they get hearts. And then I get the scenes that advance their own character arcs. I like that there's like three or four different, like you have a main path, but then you have like individual branching paths for each of the character stories. And then those can intersect with each other at points too. So like X is definitely, I think in terms of tone, probably more with where my mood has been a lot of the time. That being said, if that's the case, I probably could stand to play Xenoblade Chronicles 2, particularly because I probably could use something a little more cheery in terms of media than what Xenoblade Chronicles X is.
That's the one I tried to play.
Two,
and that's fair.
And 2 is the one that's probably most different in the series from 1, 3, and X.
It's just like a regulatory fight where I died like 20 times.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, like that's like old school RPGs for me. And like, I didn't even think to look it up online. I just was like, to hell with this. You were going to say something. I'm sorry. Brought back a memory there.
Oh, were you talking to me?
Oh, for you. Yeah, I didn't mean to talk over you.
Oh, there. No, it's. Okay, I was just going to say I agree with Adam's assessment that as far as tone is concerned, I think 1, X, and 3 kind of employ a more serious tone in terms of subject matter, whereas 2 is a little lighthearted. It certainly has serious moments, but overall it feels a bit more, definitely more anime tropey, which if that's your cup of tea and you enjoy, absolutely go for it. I think 3, though, like, is where everything that they've done so far has come together in the best way. I think 3 refined the combat, refined the open world gameplay. I don't remember as many times in 3 getting attacked by a super high level monster. I think they kind of made that easier. And it also, I felt like their writing was just so, like, it was off the wall so much better. Like, yeah. I just felt like I didn't want to put that game down. It was so good. But I'm glad that you mentioned the, like, side characters in X, because I think, like, that's what inspired the hero quests in 3, which were also kind of where you would meet these allies along the way. They'd have their own quest line and personal journeys that you could help them with. And those were some of the strongest moments in the games, like, both in X and in 3 are those moments, because that's where the game kind of, it goes from this big high-level lore, like, sci-fi experience, and it grounds it in these, like, real people that are struggling with real things in this crazy situation that they've put in. I mean, to just, like, name, like, a few, there's a guy in Xenoblade X who's looking for his partner, but you find out that, like, maybe this person doesn't actually exist. And, like, there's some things going on. And then there's also, yeah, there's also a lady, like, she does, like, all these things for everybody else, but then neglects herself. And you kind of see what happens to her, like, when she does that. And so it's just all of these situations that feel so real. But, and that kind of gives it, like, the foundation when all of this, like, crazy alien stuff is happening, like, you can kind of still feel like you can relate to what's happening in the game. And I think that sort of thing is very important, and Xenoblade does it really well.
Yeah.
I've heard with fiction, there's two ways to do it. You can either have ordinary creatures doing extraordinary things, or extraordinary creatures doing ordinary things. So the way you're describing that, that it's relatable. And I think that's, you know, you don't have to abide by that, but that's generally what it is. And I think it's because it is relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And it has that human connection that we can. And I did not say exotic. It came out like that in the transcription. I said quixotic, which is like Don Quixote.
Yep.
Is on a,
sort
of a noble quest in his own mind, but he's charging at windmills as if he's slaying a dragon. Impossible quest. That does sound intriguing. So there's a human element. I like the human element and the things that you can relate to that make you think about things and sort of have a literary almost aspect. Give you some perspective.
Yeah. And X is standalone, right? Maggie, like you don't need to play 1, 2, and 3 to get the story and the flow of X. Like it, they build a different sort of narrative to it, right?
Yes. I will say that in X's definitive edition, there is an epilogue and there is some connections that they weave there, but I don't think that it's necessary to play the other games beyond just like you would see the foundations of X's gameplay if you played the first game before X. Like you would say like, oh, I know what this gameplay system is because I noticed it in the first game.
No.
But otherwise it is very standalone, so it's approachable in that way because like all of these characters like you're meeting for the first time, so you can just kind of dive right in.
And you have the fun Nopon merchants. I always like the Nopon merchants.
Oh, I love the Nopon. They're so fun. They're like these little round potato-shaped characters that jump around.
And they often get mistaken for food, so...
Often. More often than should happen, but it does.
Yeah.
And it's Nopon. Does that mean you can't sell like your old equipment to them like you can in most RPGs? Or is that just like a name? Because like Nopon makes me think you can't sell your used equipment.
Oh, that's just there's just their name. That's their species. It's like N-O-P-O-N.
Yeah.
So no pawn. No. I don't know if my like East Tennessee accent is making that sound different than it should, but that's what they're called. So
when I hear no pawning, I'm like, oh man, I can't sell the whole equipment. I have to carry it around for the whole game. No, I can't do that.
Yeah. Wait, you said you had Maggie's hottest RPG take ever in the show notes. What is that?
Yeah. Oh no.
You did. You were there for it, Adam. You were there for it. This was amazing. This might have been the moment where I was like, okay, I need to find a way to start podcasting because I need to do a podcast with these two again. That was really it. Do you want to do it, Maggie? I think it's your take. I really think.
I'm wondering what it is because I have so many.
Oh my gosh. This was the one where you see when somebody says something to me that I've never considered, I think there's two types of people in the world. There's people who say, absolutely not. And then there's people who are like, oh, really? So, and I like to be the household variety. And you were telling me about the confluence of interests that you have as a fan of pro wrestling and RPGs.
Oh.
Which I was just like, I was blown away.
Yeah. Well, so do you want me to just go into it for just a second? Like, why?
Oh my gosh, because we're the only ones who got to hear it because you shared that with us. We didn't record that chat.
Yeah. No, that was just hung out.
I'm just still amazed that it made such an impression, but I love it because it's two things that I love so much. And I guess like why, like the intersection of how like JRPGs and wrestling, like how much those two things actually have in common is really cool. And so I guess that's the take in itself, but just to explain it, it's just amazing because like the fanfare, the epic music, the costumes, the like emotion in the feuds in wrestling all resonate much into a JRPG as well, because you just can feel like sometimes in those types of games, like there's just so much emotion. There's so much that goes into the dialogue and like those scenes. So yeah, it's just, I just love how similar they are. Sometimes I'll be watching wrestling and I'm like, that scene could have been in a JRPG because like it just feels like it would hit so hard. Like these two rivals coming together to clash for the final time at the end of the game. Like, I don't know. They're just very similar. I love that they can kind of, you know, have amazing like elements and be so unique and so alike in those ways. So I don't know. I didn't have that. I didn't have that prepared because I didn't know what to take.
I was surprised with it. You had me with theme music. You had me with theme music. That was when, if you like pro wrestling, you might enjoy Final Fantasy VII Rebirth because there are definitely some pro wrestling style rivalry moments.
Rivalries, totally goofy. Yeah. And of course, the outfits. Like, everybody in a JRPG is stylish. Everybody walking down the like path to the ring is stylish. There's pyro, there's flames. Like, obviously those are in JRPGs too. It's just funny to see how they intersect in so many ways. I love it. So
I thought the wrestling take was a very good take. And I was like, I remember reading in the show notes, I'm like, what is Maggie's hottest take? Because I know that there's so many. I knew there were so many of them. And the note in the show notes, I was like, which one, Nathan? What's the marker? What's the marker or the flag that we're going to use to talk about?
We might have a hotter take that we haven't heard now. We might have to, maybe for like season two when we get rolling see what's out there. Maybe if Maggie has one she considers a hotter take, maybe she can circle back with us on that one. I can break out my Vince McMahon hot take.
Oh my gosh.
You know, I feel conflicted with that thing because it's so fun. It's so perfect.
It is.
But I know nobody wants to see him. So I have to be judicious. There's a certain level baseline of ridiculousness with that whole endeavor. And I love that I have like rules for it. There's like rules for that meme. If you've never seen it's like the five different levels of take. We could make a Maggie hot take meme. We have like five Maggie hot takes. You know, and I want to see the one that's like nuclear crypto eyes at the bottom. But that's what's fun about that. And my main rule with that one, just so you know, like one is that they're all real. Those are all takes I've seen online. I don't make them up because what would be the fun in that? And then two, there's always at least one that I agree with. Yeah. And it's a matter of like discerning. Those who know me will like try to figure out which one I agreed with out of those, because I think that's also fun.
I love those. They're so good.
It tickles me. My favorite one was, there was one about FemC, and it had the hottest FemC take was that Persona 3 Reload is definitive because FemC is not in it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Remember that guy? There was this guy who said that. And he, well, you know what? I will say one thing. I was impressed with the Persona fandom. He was distinctly in the minority opinion on that one. I did not encourage anyone to dunk on him. He kind of brought it on himself.
He got dunked on with his own power. Yeah.
He really did. Like, he just, that was like, I'm like, that's all you, bud. And then he was a relatively good sport about it, but like, where does that take come from? Yeah. I have to think, like, maybe he was distracted running into a meeting. Oh, I'll just shoot off this reply real quick. Nobody will see it. And then, like, you know, 10,000 views later, it's like,
those were the days. Fighting in the trenches for FemC, like, oh my gosh. I'll always do it for her, but man, that was a time.
I appreciate it. It was in my top 10 list of Atlas projects I want to see. You know, and boy, a lot of old Nintendo ones. So maybe I'll switch to, we've got old Maggie, Adam. I gotta go volunteer in the community in about 20 minutes. It's been fantastic seeing both of you again. Thank you for being my guest.
Yeah, of course. It's great
to see
you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining the Amazing Gamers Podcast, a Just for Fun production that's recorded whenever Nathan has a little bit of free time and a friend to discuss a cool topic with. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and that you'll circle back with us next time. Until then, may all your gaming be amazing.